Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, as communities in Philadelphia are devastated by gun violence, we'll discuss the search for solutions. And later, we're joined by actor Stephen Ng. He stars in the one-man play, Hold These Truths at People's Light. But to start, no surprise, business has been brisk at New Jersey's new recreational marijuana dispensaries. New Jerseyans have been able to buy weed legally since Thursday, although the number of distributors open for business is still relatively small. So far, only 13 are in operation across the state, with a half dozen marijuana merchants located in South Jersey. More will open, but it is a slow rollout, which will likely take months. We're going to get the latest now from Suzette Parmley, lead cannabis reporter for NJ Advanced Media. Welcome to the Roundup, Suzette.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Well, we're
happy
to have you with us. So describe opening day. What was that like?
I was actually there promptly at 6 a.m. last Thursday. Was the grand debut of what's been literally 5 years in the making for the Garden State. It was what Governor Phil Murphy campaigned on for his first term back in, believe it or not, in fall of 2017. He wanted to do this and said that it was a way to, quote, right the wrong of our nation's war on drugs for
Yeah, I'm afraid we're getting some dropout on the line there, Suzette. So we're going to...
It's still working out some issues with the municipality in Edgewater Park.
Hey, Suzette, what we're going to do right now is switch you over to a phone connection. So I'm going to remind our listeners that we are talking about New Jersey's newly opened recreational marijuana industry businesses. Thursday was the first time that New Jerseyans could buy recreational marijuana legally. And in the next few minutes, as soon as we get reestablished with Suzette, we're going to talk about the particulars, how much a person can buy, whether a person in Pennsylvania or Delaware can cross state lines into New Jersey and purchase weed legally. Also, the cost, it's pretty high, perhaps, for many people in economically disadvantaged communities. How's that going? And et cetera, et cetera. If you'd like to give us a call and join the conversation, the number is 888-477-9499. So I understand we've got Suzette Parmley back. Are you with us? Okay, not quite yet. So again, 888-477-9499. If you'd like to join the conversation, tell us what you think, particularly if you live in New Jersey. You can also email us at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY. Another question we're going to have for Suzette regards the rules around employers who might prohibit cannabis use at work and who might drug test if you are a person who thinks you might want to buy legal weed. How might that work at your place of employment? So lots to talk about as soon as we get Suzette Parmley reestablished with us. And in the meantime, what we're going to do, actually, we're having a little bit of trouble with the connection. We're going to go to our second segment that we had planned for today. We're going to talk about the increase in gun violence deaths, in gun shooting deaths, rather, in Philadelphia since the start of the year. We're not quite 4 months old here in 2022, but shooting deaths are on pace in Philly to rival the deadly toll of 2021. The victims are all ages, a great many of them young men, but women and children and the elderly are included in the count. And the summer months are just ahead, a time when gun violence traditionally escalates. It is a crisis seemingly without end, a story that's been reported so many times that the numbers can start to lose meaning. So where do we go from here? We're going to be speaking in just a few moments with Anton Moore, a longtime community activist in South Philadelphia. And actually, I understand we do have him on the line. Anton is executive director of Unity in the Community. Hi, Anton. Welcome back.
Hey, it's good to be back. Good morning, good morning, good morning.
Good morning to you as well. And also joining us in studio is Sammy Cayola, WHYY's first gun violence prevention reporter. Sammy, so good to have you with us on the Regional Roundup.
Sammy.
Hey, Anton. Thanks for having me.
Hey.
Great to have you both with us. All right, so Anton, let's go to you first. We last had you on a year or so ago about your docuseries, The Weight of Death, which chronicles stories of loss due to gun violence in Philadelphia. When you hear about the numbers for 2022, what goes through your mind, Anton?
I mean, it's troubling. It's frustrating, but you can't lose your mind. And I say why you can't lose your mind, because sometimes when you get frustrated, you tend to blow up and say, you know what, the heck with it all. But you have to keep pushing and keep digging, because a lot of times you see the media, you know, they report on these things, but there are stories, and Sammy will tell you, and the community of great things that are going on. We just need more people to get off the sideline and get involved to get the work done to stop the gun violence.
Yeah. Well, and Sammy, when you joined WHYY, you spent the first few months in communities on kind of a listening tour. What were you hearing from residents? How did that go?
I just want to say off the bat, it's a really unconventional thing in journalism to tell a reporter not to get out and do stories right away. What I wanted to do was get to know people without having to put a microphone right in their face. I wanted to see what they were doing, so I got to go to community safety meetings, neighborhood patrol walks, youth open mics, and I got to really get acquainted with folks like Anton who are doing the work on the ground. And, you know, there is a lot of good stuff going on, sort of on two levels, right? There's violence intervention for people who were already engaged in shootings, how to get them onto a different path. And then there's backing it way, way up to work with teens who are living in violent environments, who are at risk for becoming involved. And there are ways to really empower them and give them more options and, you know, show them that they are valued and that they don't have to go in a violent direction. And that's the kind of work that I'm really excited at looking at.
It's very encouraging to hear that there is positive movement happening. And at the same time, of course, we still have this high rate of death from gun violence in the city. Sammy, so many of these shootings are caused by seemingly inconsequential things, like, say, a beef on social media. How are activist groups tackling this, the social media piece of it?
This is a new and rising element. Things can go from 0 to 100 in the blink of an eye, you know, the way that young people are talking to each other these days. And I have seen some mentors try to do what we call conflict resolution training for kids, teaching them how to settle an argument in a calm way. It's really teaching communication skills, really helping them assess, well, where am I? What are my emotions? You know, what am I feeling and why do I want to react this way? And I'm sure that Anton can talk about this too, because he probably does it with young people on a daily basis.
Yeah. So Anton, from your perspective, how is the effort to promote what's called emotional literacy going?
What do you mean, like on social media and different things like that?
Yeah.
It's tough. It's tough because you look at it, social media is a big umbrella and you really can't control everything. So not only are you trying to, you know, deal with the young people that you engage with, but also you got to bring in the other young people who might be having a conflict with some of your young people. So it's a tough situation, but I think what's good about it is that you can see young people express themselves and you can, you know, talk to them and engage with them on a personal level.
Remind us, Anton, of the reasons behind gun violence in your experience as kind of a boots-on-the-ground community activist, and why younger men in particular seem to get caught up in it.
Younger people in our community, you know, become a product of the environment. They've been around this, and some grew up in it for years. So growing up in it, this is all you see. If you put a kid in a room and all they see is four walls, and they're going to become those four walls. They're only going to know what's in that room. And that's what you look at with neighborhoods. And with my group, Unity in the Community, we try to, in our Carpentry Academy, we try to expose young people to different things and teach them, you know, different trades, and also take them out of the city to get a new perspective on life.
You don't teach gun safety. Why?
We don't teach gun safety because we don't touch on that. We want to touch on things that I think that's going to help them in the long run. I think gun safety is cool, but if you're out there committing crimes and robbing people and killing people, you're not interested in putting a gun lock or gun safety on your gun.
How do young people, Anton, get to the point where they pick up a gun? From elementary schoolers, say, to teens with guns just a few short years later. What happens there in that transition?
Well, you have to look at it from different perspectives, right? It's in the music, it's on TV, it's on social media, it's all around the world. So when you hear someone that you're influenced by talking about hurting someone and killing someone, it's almost like a Red Bull getting you amped up with a drink and giving you energy. Young people feed off of that. So you have to look at it and say to yourself, okay, what is it? What are they listening to? And how can we, you know, kind of step in and deter them from doing that? And like I said, it's an everyday battle. But I think a lot of the young kids where we come from, they grow up without a father or grow up with, you know, in a troubled household and don't have a sense of direction. But when they see, you know, a young brother like myself or other leaders that come to them and see that they really care, it gives them an option. A lot of young people, they don't have an option. They have a one-track mind and say, look, I'm going to commit violence. That's it, because no one cares. Yeah. But when they see someone that's willing to reach out to them, they say, you know what? There's the bad, but here's the good. And now they have an option to do the right thing.
Sammy Caola, summer's coming. Violence tends to increase during the warmer weather. Young people are out of school. It can be hot. There can be little access to employment. Rec centers and pools and basketball courts should provide an outlet for fun and exercise in the heat. But you found that in your reporting that parents are kind of hesitant sometimes to send kids to these places. Why?
I have spoken to a few parents who are not sure that their children will be safe if they're out in the open at a pool or on a basketball court near a rec center. You know, there have been shootings near these facilities in past summers. So the city of Philadelphia says they want to secure these properties, that can include adding officers to the area. But I've also talked to community members who said, you know, that we're still not sure that makes it safer. We'd rather send our kids, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood to a nonprofit we're familiar with, maybe somewhere indoors. So it is something I will follow as we get closer to summer, just to see who's using these programs. The city really wants them to be an oasis, a place for kids to be away from what's happening on the streets. But as Anton can probably tell you, it's going to be dangerous out there.
Yeah, Sammy, there's also a new gun violence prevention hotline in Philadelphia. Actually, it's now part of 211, right? What does that offer?
Sure. So 211 has typically been used for housing or food help. Now there is an option to press number 3 if you are worried about gun violence in your community or you yourself are involved in something. It's supposed to connect you to this group of people they're calling resource navigators, who are supposed to be trained to point you to groups in the community that are doing the work. So if you you know, have a child who needs mental health help because they're talking about harming someone, the resource navigator is supposed to get you to that service. So it's very new. It launched at the end of March. And as with anything, it is going to require trust. People have to see the city as something that can help them. And they might be more likely to just go with somebody who's already a trusted source. Some people have voiced that they don't necessarily need a liaison. They don't need to call a number. They would rather just go directly to the service. So, you know, I'll follow up in a couple of months and see who's using that.
We're going to continue our conversation on gun violence in Philadelphia with WHYY reporter Sammy Caola and also community activist Anton Moore in just a few moments here. And then we will have our conversation about legal recreational marijuana in New Jersey. Stay tuned as the regional roundup continues on WHYY in Philadelphia.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We've switched the order of our segments around a little bit this hour. Right now we are talking about the high rate of gun violence in the city of Philadelphia and potential solutions that are happening on the community level and within the city itself. Sammy Caola is our gun violence prevention reporter here at WHYY. Anton Moore is a longtime community activist and the head of Unity in the Community. Welcome back to both of you. And Anton, I wanted to get to, just for a moment or two, talk about policing in neighborhoods. I mean, few people want to see communities where the majority of violence is happening become mini police states. But some neighbors have asked for kind of a triage of policing efforts, if you will, have perhaps more cops on the beat or in cars around basketball courts or rec centers where there might be a higher probability that young people could be caught in the crossfire. What is your take on policing efforts to deter gunfire. What do you think? Is there a balance here to be had?
There's definitely a balance here to be had, and we must be respectful of the neighbors, but also we must listen to their concerns. When the neighbors say, look, you know, I'm having a tough time taking my daughter to school because I don't want to be shot. When a senior citizen says, you know, I don't come out at a certain time because I have a fear of getting robbed. Those are concerns of neighbors, and we should never get into the business and telling them how they feel. Oftentimes I hear, you know, different people say, well, we need to take police out of neighborhoods and this, this, and that. I'm like, hold up. If his body's dropping on the ground and people are getting killed and people are getting shot, we need to listen to the people that's living in those neighborhoods and ask them, what do you need and what will make you feel safe? And that's what we're looking at right now. When I talk to people and I engage the people, first thing they say is, we want to be safe. We want cops on the beat. We want to be able to have our kids play at the rec centers. They are legitimate concerns because I come from Tasker Home Projects, which was a violent area, but I love where I grew up at. But we understood that it was great when we were able to play in the park and not have to worry about gunshots and bullets. Now the kids have to deal with that. So as leaders, we need to hear people's concerns and address them accordingly.
Sammy, you want to weigh in?
I just want to note that there is a budget proposal on the table, and there is a lot of debate going on about how much funding should be going to policing for gun violence. And some people think it's not prevention so much as, you know, as Anton is saying, a feeling of making people feel like somebody is watching. There's also, though, a call to enhance our social services systems, right? There was a 100 shootings review that the city did that found that, you know, many, many shooters went through the Department of Health Services at some point. And the question is, well, why can't we catch those people way before they commit a crime, way before police would be needed? And should we be using our funding to enhance some of those safety net systems? So that's just a conversation I'll be tracking.
And let's also talk, Sammy, about financial support for community groups trying to lessen the number of shootings. There is a grant program in place in the city, but things have gotten a little rocky lately with that grant money.
Certainly. So you're referring to the targeted community investment grants. Yeah. There have been four rounds. There are sort of, you know, they range from $10,000 to $40,000, and they're supposed to go to nonprofits that prevent gun violence. But this past round, the fourth round, there were a lot of delays in payment. By the end of February, groups were supposed to be paid. Many that I spoke to just were not. The group that the city works with to distribute the money said there were issues with staffing, technical problems. And I keep talking to nonprofits that are supposed to receive these grants, and they still haven't. And they said the paperwork to get the grants has been really onerous for them. And a lot of these are small shops, and they don't have a lot of staff. They're not used to navigating a grant process. So there's a lot of calls for the city to do better in the fifth round that's coming up in May.
Any sense as to what might happen next, if there might be some clarification of the process?
Well, they are holding informational sessions. The city is launching these workshops so people can ask questions about how they're supposed to navigate this grant process. And they've added some staff, some liaison staff, which will hopefully make it a smoother go.
Anton Moore, the Republican-led legislature in Pennsylvania has refused over and over to allow Philly and other municipalities to implement tougher local gun laws. You know, if you had a chance to address state lawmakers at large right now, what would you say to them?
I will ask them, first, do you have children at home? And I will say to them, you know, how would it feel if you saw your child laying in the streets at the hands of someone murdering them? Well, that's what we're dealing with every day in the city of Philadelphia. If I had it my way, I would take some buses up to these rural counties who like to block gun reform in Philadelphia and have bodies land in the middle of the street as a protest to show them, this is what we're dealing with every day. And even as far as the grants, you know, it's important that we get, you know, private funders involved to actually fund some of these groups as well. You know what I mean? I talk to people from the city and people from the Urban Affairs Coalition, and I get it. It's issues, and they're trying to work through those issues. But we need other people to get involved because this is critical. No one can sit on the sideline when bodies are dropping. You had two women killed the other day in Frankfurt. Those things are that's horrendous. So when I look at that and I think of Republicans and the funders and stuff like that, everybody needs to get involved to do their part to make a difference when it comes to the issue of gun violence in Philadelphia.
How, Ann, Tom, would you grade the Kenny administration's response to the escalation in gun violence in recent years?
You know what? I'm going to say this, right? I would give him a B minus C. I can't give anyone an A because there's too many bodies dropping. You know what I mean? I can't give them an F because Kenny administration did do something that a lot of administrations didn't do. A lot of groups and a lot of people have been receiving funding that don't have a 501c3. And I've seen some amazing things happen on the ground with young people and groups that were sitting on the sideline, but now they're doing work to make the neighborhoods better. As I mentioned, you'll always see the bad things in the media and on social media, but there are some awesome people that are doing great work that receive the grants. Everybody can do better, but I would say I'll give them a C.
Okay. Sammy, we've got about a minute left. You just published a story about environmental improvements and how these can impact people's lives positively, perhaps by hopefully lessening the chance for gun violence.
That is the hope. There are some studies, a recent one out of UPenn, 2018, showing that when they greened vacant lots, turned them into more of a park-like setting, that gun crime went down by 29%. And where there were lots that were just left untouched, there was no decrease. So, you know, it's hard to say if that will always be the case, if it's a direct causation, but
that's a big number.
Promising. It's a big drop. And, you know, I talked to people who said, if it looks nicer there and if kids are playing there, then, you know, it'll be a deterrent because shooters won't want to shoot each other in a place that's a community place necessarily. And also it just increases mental well-being. People are calmer when they have green space that they can look at. So, you know, what I liked about that story is people just took it upon themselves to do it. Like Anton said, nobody can sit on the sidelines. People just got their hands dirty. They just built a garden where it used to just be some overgrown grass and concrete, you know, and they made the change they wanted to see in their neighborhood, which is pretty impressive.
Anton, about 10 seconds. Do you feel real hope for change?
I feel real hope for change, and I want people to get off the sidelines and get involved. If you want to support the work we're doing, you can log on to our website, unityinthecommunity215.com, and click the donate link. We'll open up a resource center to help people with grieving counseling, resume writing, computer skills, and all that good stuff.
All right. Anton, always a pleasure to have you with us. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Anton Moore is Executive Director of Unity in the Community. And Sammy Cayola, great to have you with us as well.
Thanks for having me.
Sammy is WHYY's Gun Violence Prevention Reporter. Okay, we are now going to turn to legal weed in New Jersey. It's been just a few days, and we have Suzette Parmley, lead cannabis reporter for NJ Advanced Media, with us now. Welcome again, Suzette.
Mary, thank you so much. Good morning.
Good morning. So let's get to the particulars. If an adult wants to buy recreational marijuana in New Jersey, well, first, you have to be at least 21 years old, and there is a limit to the amount of each purchase. Tell us about that.
Yes, you're allowed per visit, per dispensary in New Jersey, up to one ounce, Mary. And they are expecting folks from Pennsylvania. Roughly one in every five consumers is going to be estimated to come from Pennsylvania into New Jersey, which is allowed. What isn't allowed is, as you know, Pennsylvania hasn't legalized it, so you would have to consume it in, buy it and consume it in New Jersey.
So for those from Pennsylvania or even Delaware hasn't legalized yet who want to just bring it back, is there going to be any sort of enforcement on those lines? Have you heard of anything, Suzette?
They're going to definitely try, but it is one of those things. It's a fluid situation right now, Mary, because there's a lot of things that are what they're watching, the cross lines, sales, and also, you know, minors. You are correct. You have to be 21 to buy this and to possess it and use it in New Jersey. It's a work in progress right now. They are monitoring that. And you could tell by the license plates outside these dispensaries.
Yeah, I'm sure. what are the rules around recreational marijuana use in New Jersey? Can you smoke it at the beach? Can you consume edibles at the mall? How does that work?
It's, believe it or not, it's exactly the same parameters you have with alcohol, a case of beer. Police cannot stop you now if you smell of marijuana or your car smells of marijuana. It is legal to possess it. What's not legal is if you use it and you cause injury or harm to somebody else. That's why they do not recommend you buy it, go in your car and start using it and driving home. There are rules at every property. If it's a private property, if you have an apartment complex, your landlord can set the rules in terms of where you can use it or you can't use it and anywhere on his property. Same with the beach. There are beaches that prohibit alcohol usage on the beach. It's the same thing with marijuana. You can have it on you, but it's going to depend on every facility, public and private, if you're going to be allowed to use it on the premise.
And what are the rules about smoking weed and employers, Suzette, who prohibit cannabis use at work and who might drug test?
I had to do a whole education on this myself because I've written about it. This is one of the most complicated situations now where you have to do something adverse on the job to be fired, meaning you can now test positive. It's now off the illegal controlled substance classification on the state level, where if I apply to a job, I happen to get past the first interview, and let's say I do test positive for weed. I had it over the weekend. An employer cannot not hire you now if you test positive for marijuana. If that's the only thing holding you back from landing that job, they legally cannot deny you the job. Okay. What can happen is they can fire you if they can prove that you were positive at the time something went wrong at the plant, that you endangered a colleague or a customer and jeopardize or compromise their safety. But there has to be something on your part you did to cause that for them to take adverse action. Otherwise, they are liable as an employer for discriminating against you. Possessing weed is no longer illegal, and testing positive is no longer a detriment for you to getting a job in New Jersey.
Suzette, some states like California have policies in effect which regulate marijuana use among those who are called safety-sensitive employees, such as police officers, because marijuana can stay in the body, for a number of days. New Jersey doesn't have any such policies in place, though Governor Murphy has said he's open to such restrictions. Are you seeing any movement among state lawmakers to consider this?
There is support among lawmakers, but here's a caveat. The Senate President, Nick Scutari, who actually was the grandfather of both the medical and recreational cannabis, he sponsored both major bills in New Jersey. He came out last week and said he is not going in that direction of, regulating what someone, a police officer, will do on his off time. That's like telling an officer you can't drink beer on your weekend. Of course, this is in contradiction to what Governor Bill Murphy was saying. Well, this has their jobs is very case sensitive. They are dealing with public safety. There are going to be lawsuits of people questioning their impairment or judgment on the job if they arrest them and they're high on, if the cop is still under the influence of cannabis. What if they arrest somebody and they were in the right frame of mind, is the whole debate. This is a hot potato right now, and it just started. The market just legalized last Thursday, but it is being talked about. Governor Murphy said he is open to legislation and signing legislation that would ban police officers from having weed off duty. Now you have the most powerful lawmaker, the Senate President, also a Democrat, saying, I don't want to go that direction. That's basically telling cops what to do on their off time. And it would be like telling them they can't have, they can't go to a bar or have a beer on their weekend. So this is going to be playing out.
Much more to that story. Yeah, it'll be unfolding. I'm sure we'll keep an eye on it. So, Suzette, the recreational marijuana industry is expected to be lucrative, raking in, millions if not billions. And the state has made a concerted effort to help get small operators get a foot in the door. When might some of these smaller businesses start selling, and many of which would be in economically disadvantaged areas? Because right now there are, just over a dozen dispensaries open across the state.
Yes, you're correct, Mary. Right on target there. There are only 12, actually. The 13th one is still dealing with municipal issues with the municipality. So that's in Edgewater Park. I did a story Friday there. They're going to take a few extra days, but that only takes up the store count to 13 in New Jersey. If you compare that to Illinois, Illinois started with 102 dispensaries off the bat out of the gate. The problem in New Jersey, you had so few, you only have 24 actual current existing medical dispensaries. So half of those, not even half, I'd say a third, 7 were approved. Each one of those 7 is having at least 2 stores open, with the exception of 1. That gets you to 13 stores. That's extremely low. So the other end of the equation, part of this bill is to help out the impact zones, the communities most impacted by the quote failed war on drugs. And a lot of these applicants are coming from these disadvantaged communities. They want to get those small businesses up and going and give them preference, women and minority-owned businesses, to get these licenses. The difficulty is going to take, once they get that license, it's going to take about a year, Mary, believe it or not a few months, not several months. They're saying by next spring you'll have more online from these smaller businesses, because they not only have to grow the crop, they have to build out their facilities. They don't exist anywhere yet.
It's like time and money, right, Suzette? Time and money, a lot of
and
money.
Time and money.
Yeah.
These are the I'll explain where this comes from. A big component of the legalization bill for recreational marijuana in New Jersey is called social or restorative justice component. When they're trying to help out these minorities most impacted by the war on drugs, meaning the black and brown communities whose members were sent to jail or arrested in massive numbers. And to reverse that, they want to give a good 30% of the revenue, 70% of that revenue from recreational weed sales to go back into these so-called impact zones.
Okay. We've only got about 15 seconds left. I'm sorry, Suzette.
But that's the big part of this, is to helping out the communities most impacted by the failed war on drugs.
All right.
And that revenue from recreational adult will be doing that.
Again, a lot more to this story. We will be following it here on the Roundup. Suzette Parmley of NJ Advanced Media, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mary. A pleasure. Thank you so much.
Up next, we speak with actor Stephen Ng, who is starring in the play Hold These Truths at People's Light. He's live in studio. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Welcome back. Actor Stephen Ng's latest undertaking is outstanding and compelling theater. Ng stars in the People's Light production Hold These Truths, the poignant telling of the story of Gordon Hirabayashi, a young American college student of Japanese descent who found himself caught up in the anti-Japanese sentiment of World War II. Hirabayashi pushes back hard against Franklin Roosevelt's controversial Order 9066, which sent Japanese Americans to internment camps. He refused to go or comply with a curfew and then turned himself into the FBI, saying he considered it his duty to, quote, maintain the democratic standards for which this nation lives. Hirabayashi's case eventually made it to the U.S. Supreme Court, which ruled against him. Ng plays Hirabayashi masterfully, along with 37 other characters in this one-man play. Stephen Ng is also a drama teacher at NYU and co-founder of the National Asian Artists Project, and he joins us in studio for the remainder of the hour. Welcome. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me, Mary.
Well, I have to say I just loved your performance.
Oh, thanks.
It really brings Gordon Hirabayashi's story to life. How did you come to be involved in this project?
Well, a few years ago, I would say it was probably about 3 years ago, I was working on another project. It was the first time I had worked with director Desdemona Chang. And without realizing that her next upcoming project would be this production of Hold These Truths. And I think just for our brief time working on this other project together, she had... luckily for me, probably felt like that maybe I was the right candidate, the right actor to be doing this project. So as a result, after that project we finished, this got in motion, And then so 2 years ago, before COVID, 2 years ago, I started working on this project.
So tell us a bit more about who Gordon Hirabayashi was and the work you did to capture his essence.
Yes. Gordon Hirabayashi was a Japanese-American born in the United States, but his parents were Japanese immigrants and up in Washington State in the Seattle area. And he was born in 18, I believe, something like that.
Yeah.
And so very much growing up kind of with one foot in Americana and another foot in this traditional Japanese environment, traditional in the sense of how his parents had raised him. And so life began to change, of course, and a whole entirely new perspective on life once he got to college. And so, and as a result, he became a lot more politically savvy or politically aware, I'll put it that way, a lot more politically aware about what it really means to be an American. And as a result, and the time just happened to coincide with the beginning of World War II. And as a result, he began to really recognize what it meant to him to being an American, how that had developed from just being this identity of whatever American is, means, to actually what rights it means, his own responsibilities as an American. And there, so this entire world awareness really developed as a young college student. And it coincided again with World War II. And as a result, he started to see a lot of injustices that he had actually grown up being used to. So it was just the given. But then the deprivation of these rights became much, much more pronounced and, of course, amplified by what happened, all that was happening during the World War II.
Well, Stephen Eng, I understand that you'll perform a scene in which Gordon is at college.
Yes.
And news of the bombing of Pearl Harbor.
Correct.
Is just coming in.
Yes. At the beginning of fall quarter 41, I move back to Eagleson Hall and catch up with Howie and Esther. And one quiet December morning, I'm walking to the Friends meeting house. The sun is shining, the birds are singing, when Howie comes racing down the stairs. Gordy, Japan has bombed Pearl Harbor, the naval base in Hawaii. Pearl Harbor's been bombed by the Japanese. The president has declared war. It's all over the radio. Gordy, you okay? It doesn't sound real. It doesn't fit the quiet morning. The sunshine, the chirping of birds. I hear it, but it won't register. America attacked by Japan? No. No!
Thank you. Thank you, Stephen. Gordon Hirabayashi is devastated. He's an American. And yet when curfew and evacuation orders are soon initiated by the federal government, he feels betrayed by America that he's the other.
Absolutely. And the awareness of this otherness, which I describe at the beginning of the play when he's like roughly 5 years old, and he actually begins to be aware that he physically looks very different from other people around him, and then suddenly beginning to recognize cultural practices that, you know, are second nature to him are actually quite different. The awareness of otherness begins there. But then I think until college, he retains this kind of separation of the immigrant culture and being an American. And he establishes, actually, I think, growing up, a very clear line. There, it's reflected in a scene that he has with his mother where he tells his mother, you know, I realize you're not an American, so you don't have the protections that I do. Yeah. So don't worry, I'll take care of you. And that awareness is completely shattered when he discovers that even being an American does not guarantee him the rights that he had thought he was entitled to as a citizen of the United States.
So there's a scene in which you play both Gordon and his mom is worried sick about Gordon because he's refused to go to an internment camp. You really, Stephen, you nail it in the scene. You embody the worried mother, her voice, the accent of a Japanese immigrant, and Gordon as well, as they're going back and forth. What went into preparing for this scene?
Well, I think a lot of the preparation for the scene is really just continuing to really want to invest in the humanity of what the individual character is experiencing as the mother and then also Gordon. So the challenge, of course, is jumping back and forth between the two right in the middle of the scene. Yeah. However, I think the key is really embodying that the familiarity of humanity, what it means to feel scared, to feel threatened, to feel like your entire life that you have developed is about to be stripped away from you. And they both feel that in their own way. And then what that's going to happen to the family unit, which is so foundational to them and their community.
Let's talk about the physical and the mental challenges of performing a one-man play in which you are toggling back and forth, sometimes in rapid-fire succession between different characters. You know, Gordon's the primary character. How do you stay focused and on point with this split-second timing? I could never do it. I'm not an actor, but, you know, I would be completely confused.
Well,
how do you do it?
I will say it's helpful to rehearse.
Of course.
Because to up to a point, like many other skills, once the body begins to get used to it and to begin to feel comfortable, so much so that the brain can calm down, then the ability to execute difficult or complicated things become a lot more fluid. I don't ever want to say easier, but less angst-ridden, because at the beginning it was actually quite difficult.
How long did it take you to get that to master it?
Well, it took me many months of just learning the lines and see if it can just come out of my mouth without thinking too hard.
Yeah. Let's go to, I guess, a more serious subject. The application of this play and its content to today. You know, during the play, following the word of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the character of Gordon Hirabayashi reads directives issued by the government in which people of Japanese descent, including Japanese Americans, are referred to as alien populations. This is this something that was chilling when you first came across those words?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And for me, as an American, just the idea of being considered
an alien.
Yeah. Is just so foreign to me. funny, I use that in the same sentence, foreign and alien. But just the idea of not being able to consider myself someone who belongs here. I think that's what a lot of people experience, particularly
to this day.
Illegal aliens.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And there's actually, you know, it's a lot of, you know, word play, but in the play, one of the announcements by the government when they first announced the curfew is that the curfew is also going to apply to non-aliens. And Gordon has to take a moment in the play to figure out, what does non-alien mean? Mm. Someone who isn't an alien. Oh, someone who was born here. Oh, citizens. But, of course, you had to do those mental gymnastics
yeah.
through the words to understand what this order is actually calling for. Because you can really play a lot with some equivocating with just words.
Yeah. You told producer Paige Murray Bessler there are certain experiences Gordon had that you feel you have personal experience with, such as what?
Absolutely. Well, I'm a product, a child of immigrants who came to the United States with very little and really spent their entire lives just trying to make a comfortable home for their children and a place where their children could thrive. And that included working a lot of really difficult jobs. My father was a cook in the back, you know, Chinese restaurants. My mother was a waitress. I mean, and these are really hard jobs physically on the body, certainly mentally too. And because of a limited amount of education back in China, et cetera, there was only so far they could go here. And I actually really identified with that struggle of my immigrant parents really making the life that they felt was something they wanted to give their child. And I consider myself such a beneficiary, such a very lucky beneficiary that I had parents like that. And there was a lot of struggle as immigrants trying to not just make their way in the world, but trying to provide opportunities that did not exist for them.
There has been a lot of hate directed at the Asian American Pacific Islander community during the pandemic. Has it changed your relationship to the role that you are playing now?
Oh, no question.
How?
No question. Well, let me first say that, you know, we started this project 2 years ago. We shut down in technical rehearsals because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
And I think we are all, many of your listeners are very aware that the last 2 years of the pandemic has brought out many elements of society that we actually, and I say a collective we, did not really ever expect to have such a voice and to be able to have such a frightening impact and I'll just say it from my point of view, the Asian American or AAPI community.
Yeah.
And so that is certainly something that has changed for me from when I began this project to the significant deepening of my experience of what's going on right now in the world, in American society, that I'm quite frankly still very shocked about.
So People's Light streamed the show during the pandemic, and we are all thankful that the arts were able to use this medium to carry on. But for an actor, Stephen Ng, safe to say there's nothing like being on stage with the audience right in front of you.
Absolutely. And, you know, particularly it's why this is so essential for this particular show, because the audience is my acting partner.
How so?
Oh, how much they're responding to me. They look at me in the face, in the eyes. I see them because they're all pretty close enough to me that what I get from them, from their faces, from their physical, from their body language, from the expressions that they might utter in a moment, just a brief laugh, suddenly affects me in the moment. So there's nothing like the live theater. And this, for me, is just the perfect example of why I consider myself very much a theater animal.
Let's talk about the Asian American team, which has produced this show. There's a Jean Sakata script. Also, tell us about the set, the lighting, the music.
Well, okay, so it's really quite special because of the Asian American team, a full creative team, which, quite frankly, even in my having been around for a little while, never happens. It never happens. And People's Light made a concerted effort to create a full Asian American team. And it's not that the design elements are quote unquote Asian in any way. This is very much an American story. And yet, all of us as Asians, Asian Americans, very much identify with the Americanism within us, that's what we bring to this production. So from the design, from the set to the lights, there's nothing I would say distinctly Asian about it in any way. It's very American.
So what do you want people to take away from Hold These Truths?
I think one of the things I want people to take away is how precious the rights we are given really are, and that I've certainly, even through this experience, have become much more sensitive to how precious these rights can be and how these rights can be taken away just when we think, oh, there's no way. There's just no way, you know, the politicians would never dare to remove these laws that we hold very dear to us. It's important to always keep our eye out and to also stick up for those who are in threat of losing it.
Stephen Ng, I will have to leave it there, but it was great for you. Great to have you here in studio with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure.
Enjoy the rest of the run.
Thank you very much.
The play is Hold These Truths. You'll find it at People's Light through May 1st. Diana Martinez is our engineer today. Our producer, Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us for the Regional Roundup. Be well.